The Spectator is Europe's fastest growing current affairs magazine. Subscribe today and find out why. You'll get 12 weeks in print and online for just £12. Plus, we'll send you a bottle of Spectator gin worth £30. So if you do the math, you'll work out that is absolutely free. Go to www.spectator.co.uk/gin.
Hello and welcome to Spectator Out Loud. Every week, a few of our favourite writers read out their pieces from the magazine. This week, we're going to be joined by Dominic Green, Spectator USA's life and art editor, who reads his piece about Prince Harry's new job. We'll also be hearing from Philip Eade, a biographer of Prince Philip, who reads his obituary of the prince. Next, we'll hear from Anshul Pfeffer, the Israeli journalist, about how vaccine passports are already redundant in Israel. And finally, Lionel Shriver, on how the West is tearing itself apart and who stands to gain from that. First up, it's Philip Eade on Prince Philip.
Prince Philip played a pivotal yet often underestimated role in ensuring the survival of the modern British monarchy. His self-confidence and irreverence served as an invaluable foil for the young Queen Elizabeth, enabling her to overcome her natural shyness and giving her the confidence and stability to reign so calmly and irreproachably for such a long time. As Britain's longest-serving consort, he outlasted 14 prime ministers and carried out a staggering 22,000 solo public engagements, joking shortly before his retirement from royal duties in 2017 that he was probably the world's most experienced plaque unveiler. When the mathematician Sir Michael Attia told the prince how sorry he was to hear he was standing down, Philip riposted in characteristic fashion, "Well, I can't stand up much longer." Prince Philip's achievement was all the more remarkable given that his overtly masculine, forthright and restless character did not obviously equip him to play second fiddle. Yet ever since the Queen's accession to the throne in 1952, he had been required to address his wife as ma'am in public and to bow whenever she entered a room. I first had the idea of writing his biography when he was in his late 80s, around the time that he broke the record set by Queen Charlotte, George III's consort, from 1761 until her death 57 years later. However, my inspiration was not so much the thought of his extraordinarily enduring public service, but rather a story I had read about the prince once asking his equerry to go and meet an extraterrestrial humanoid at a house in Ealing, West London. Air Marshal Sir Peter Horsley, the said equerry, had been on the prince's staff from 1952 until 1955, before climbing to great heights in the RAF. "Oh God," exclaimed an official at the Ministry of Defence when the equerry's memoirs came out in 1987, "how unfortunate that the public will learn that the man who had his finger on the button of strike command was seeing little green men." The public also learned that for several years in the early 1950s, Prince Philip had enthusiastically exchanged reports of UFOs with his uncle, Lord Louis Mountbatten, a fellow subscriber to the Flying Saucer Review, and kept himself informed about all the latest developments in the field. As Horsley recalled, "Prince Philip was open to the immense possibilities leading to space exploration, while at the same time not discounting that, just as we were on the fringe of breaking into space, so older civilizations in the universe might already have done so." According to Horsley, the open-minded young prince agreed that I could investigate the more credible reports, provided that I kept it all in perspective and did not involve his office in any kind of publicity or sponsorship. A select few witnesses were invited to Buckingham Palace to discuss their experiences, partly, as the equerry later explained, to, as he said, put them on the spot and to test their honesty in the presence of royalty, a method as effective as truth serum. This all seemed like good material for a book I was then toying with writing about ufologists in the period just after the Second World War. However, the more I looked into Prince Philip, the more it became apparent that his interest in flying saucers was far from being the most interesting thing about him. He was, after all, famously revered as a living god by the islanders of Vanuatu in the South Pacific. Above all, though, I was drawn to the extraordinary story of his childhood, which was so traumatic that in these softer times he might easily have been taken into care by the social services, or at least spent the rest of his life in therapy, a notion that you can be sure the adult Prince Philip would have scoffed at. Born on the Greek island of Corfu in 1921, 8 years after the assassination of his grandfather, King George I of Greece, an imported monarch from Denmark. Prince Philip was still an infant when a British warship rescued his family from the hands of revolutionaries, a mission instigated by Britain's King George V, first cousin of Prince Philip's father, Prince Andrea, who was anxious to atone for having failed to save their fellow first cousin, Tsar Nicholas II of Russia, in 1918. In exile on the outskirts of Paris, the young prince's world was again thrown asunder in 1930 when his mother, Princess Alice, suffered a severe mental breakdown and was bundled off to a secure psychiatric clinic, and his father abandoned his family to live with his mistress. Philip's elder sisters would soon be married, all of them to German princes, so the family's breakup was most keenly felt by their 8-year-old brother, who was now effectively an orphan. For 5 years he saw his father only occasionally and received no word from his mother, not even a birthday card. Consigned to the care of his uncles in Britain, he was sent to board at Cheam Prep School and then in 1933 to his brother-in-law's school in Germany, which had been steadily Nazified since Hitler's rise to power. Then, to his relief, back to Britain and to the new progressive school in Scotland, Gordonston, whose Spartan educational philosophy made a lasting impression on the embattled prince. It proved to be a fulfilling and happy time until further family tragedy struck. In 1937, Philip's favourite sister and her family were on their way to a family wedding in London when the plane crashed in fog, killing everyone on board. Even before this latest tragedy, the 16-year-old prince had suffered more than his fair share of blows, and perhaps thus fortified, he did not break down when he learned what had happened, his headmaster later recording that his sorrow was that of a man. A few days later, Philip travelled out to the funeral in Germany and forlornly followed the coffins on foot, just as he would do 60 years later with the princes William and Harry after the death of their mother, Princess Diana. Philip's elder uncle, Georgie, the second Marquess of Milford Haven, had come as close as anyone to providing him with love and stability since his mother's breakdown, but the next year he too died suddenly from cancer, aged 44, and so his more glittering younger brother, Lord Louis Mountbatten, stepped in to finish the job of bringing his nephew up. Mountbatten had long been impressed with the way that his nephew coped with all the vicissitudes in his life, and had his own ideas about what use he could make of his singularly robust and self-reliant character. It was Mountbatten who orchestrated the fateful meeting between Prince Philip and his cousin Princess Elizabeth at Dartmouth in 1939, when the 13-year-old princess became famously and irrevocably smitten. And he later did all he could to encourage his nephew to press his suit and to remove any obstacles in his path. Monarchists should feel extremely glad that he did so. As the Queen's strength and stay, as she described him, for 7 decades, he provided the essential support on which her singularly successful reign depended.
That was Philip Ead. Next, Dominic Green, about Prince Harry's new job.
Prince Harry is now Chief Impact Officer for BetterUp, a Californian corporate consultancy whose mission is to sell online life coaching with, in his words, not mine, innovation, impact and integrity. Harry may not realise it, but he is the latest celebrity frontman for the rapidly growing, broadly unregulated and frequently dubious corporate coaching industry. And you might not realise it, but Harry, Duke of Malibu, is your future too, because California's today is America's tomorrow and Britain's next week. BetterUp is one of a group of Californian companies on the growing corporate edge of life coaching. Its competitors have names like Workbot, Hone, and Clear Review, and they all claim to have discovered the secret to improving motivation and productivity at every level of corporate life, using data modelling and artificial intelligence to target what BetterUp calls hyper-personalised coaching at every employee. Imagine Big Brother running the Department of Human Resources in the voice of an especially insistent yoga instructor. Imagine a future in which your boss feels you're not productive enough, so he sends you to online therapy to make you a better worker and receives reports on your innermost emotions. BetterUp was co-founded in 2013 by a 27-year-old Texan named Alexei Robichaud. At the time, he was, he says, bummed by his experiences as a Silicon Valley product manager and soul-searching for a better way to do digital business, I started to look for help and engaged in everything from executive coaching to life coaching to therapy to self-help books. I even walked across Spain on the Camino de Santiago. Robichaud says that his vision crystallized on his pilgrimage to use technology to scale coaching and make the lives of millions of professionals better. BetterUp now calls itself the world's largest coaching network. It has 270 full-time employees and subcontracts the services of 2,000 coaches to more than 300 companies, including NASA, Hilton, Chevron, and WarnerMedia. In February, BetterUp's market value was more than $1.7 billion, and that was before the wave of publicity and interest when Prince Harry joined the firm. In early March, 3 weeks before Harry announced that he'd personally found working with a BetterUp coach to be invaluable, the company launched two new products, Identify AI and Coaching Clouds. Identify AI gathers data on every employee, where each person is in their career, their mindsets and behaviors, learning preferences, and it assesses their readiness for coaching. It then filters this information through a company's strategic priorities to identify who the right people are to invest in and the appropriate dosage and type of coaching needed to best meet their needs. Coaching Clouds comprises three layers of hyper-personalized coaching. The top layer, executive coaching, will keep you in the corner office. In Professional Clouds, coaches with at least 10 years of prior corporate coaching mentor emerging leaders and high-potential individual contributors. The third format, Field Cloud, is aimed at frontline employees, cannon fodder, like customer service agents and retail associates, call center workers, for instance, who are coached to show more empathy. Robichaud claims BetterUp's data demonstrates that when employees are offered learning programs tailored to their preferences, they put twice as much effort into learning and development and experience a 180% increase in job effectiveness. He doesn't say what happens to employees who refuse the offer or dislike the dosage or lack the requisite readiness to submit to COD psychiatric management speak. BetterUp claims to give its clients a validated quantitative measure of the impact of our service, but there is no external assessment, and the validation and quantitative measurement are as arbitrary as BetterUp's sales pitch. For BetterUp, meaning and satisfaction lie in the directing of work towards a collective goal. But there can be no objective measure of how people feel about their jobs. Consider Meghan, Duchess of Sussex's dissatisfaction when she was temping in Britain and how she felt about the firm's collective goals. And who would dare to tell the boss that they think it's intrusive of BetterUp to isolate the psychological factors that determine whether, short of a medical emergency, an employee chooses to come to work, or that it's manipulative to use an algorithm to detect individual failures in nutrition or sleep? And who'd dare suggest that it can be irrelevant whether a worker is insufficiently keen on diversity and inclusion, or even that BetterUp is a sinister waste of time? Laszlo Bock, who worked on Google's attempt at data-driven HR, calls the promise of data-driven efficiency Silicon Valley fairy dust. Peter Capelli, a professor of management at the Wharton School of Business, believes that there is, quote, virtually nothing, indeed nothing I can think of, at the level of the individual employee that clearly drives revenue and so forth. There are far too many steps in the chain. Business coaching and life coaching are the modern faces of what the boomers called the human potential movement. The HPM's godfather was Abraham Maslow, who devised the now ubiquitous hierarchy of needs, a triangle with the physiological basics at the bottom and self-actualization at the top. The goal of therapy was no longer Sigmund Freud's modest aim of reconciling the patient to ordinary unhappiness. It was unleashing everyone's innate genius. Not surprisingly, the HPM took off in California in the 60s. Incubated at the Esalen Institute at Big Sur, it became the counterculture's way of doing self-help, the long, strange trip of encounter groups, gestalt therapy, Zen, holotropic breathwork, and transcendental meditation. As the boomers aged, the seekers and swingers in the hot springs at Esalen mutated into the spiritual businessmen of the 70s and 80s. In 1971, Werner Erhardt, a car salesman influenced by Napoleon Hill's Think and Grow Rich, launched Erhardt Seminars Training in San Francisco. EST was a therapeutic boot camp. No wristwatches, no bathroom breaks, and no talking until spoken to. The goal was to force rapid enlightenment about your personal potential through what Erhardt called ruthless compassion. Erhardt is still alive and highly litigious, so you'll have to look up online to read how he beat accusations of incest, bullying, and tax evasion. In 1984, he launched a less ruthless version of EST called the Forum, and its successor, Landmark, is still going. You may be familiar with the glassy-eyed zeal of graduates of Landmark's three-day psychotic break, the Landmark Forum. They sound not unlike Prince Harry when he gushes about peak performance, transforming pain into purpose, and unlocking potential and opportunity that we never knew we had inside of us. There is no federal oversight of America's coaching industry. Anyone can call themselves a life coach or a business coach. BetterUp says that its coaches are ICF-certified experts or licensed therapists. The ICF is the International Coaching Federation. Its founder, Thomas J. Leonard, worked at EST in the 1980s. He also founded the International Association of Coaching, which sells ICF-accredited courses, and Coachville, which sells add-on training and coaches the coaches at its Center for Coaching Mastery. So the ICF is not a neutral self-regulator like the American Bar Association. It's part of the coaching economy. Apart from selling accreditation, the ICF runs a Coaching in Organizations program for businesses and a thought leadership institute that facilitates interaction between innovators, technologists, venture capitalists, press, and influencers. It also sells tickets to ICF Converge, its annual seminar for coaches. The modern coaching industry is to Sigmund Freud what Ronald McDonald is to Auguste Escoffier. Workers are sliced and diced into profiles through a kind of digital astrology. Corporations love this because it promises to raise productivity and reduce healthcare costs. Insurers love it for the same reasons. It's almost painful to think that Prince Harry believes his enlistment as a corporate mascot will have a positive impact on mental health in the boardrooms and call centres of America, when the only impact of him serving as the credulous face of a dodgy and shoddily regulated industry will be to embarrass his family once again.
That was Dominic Green. Now, Anshul Pfeffer about Israel's vaccine passports.
The vaccination centre where I got my jabs was in the cavernous foyer of the Jerusalem Arena, Israel's largest sports venue. Through the locked glass doors, I could see the seats where my 15-year-old and I spent so many hours cheering on our basketball team. Putting my ear to the door, I could hear the players practicing. Last week, we were finally back in the stands after a year's absence. Fans were allowed in, a quarter of the arena's capacity. After showing my season ticket, I was then asked for my green pass, which proves I have been vaccinated. My son, too young for vaccination, had to queue outside for a quick COVID test before joining me. In the month since I downloaded my vaccination passport to my smartphone, this was the second time I'd been asked to present it. Everything seemed organized when we arrived at the stadium, but it quickly transformed into the regular chaos. The announcer reminded the fans to maintain a 2-meter distance from each other, but no one paid attention and the stewards weren't enforcing it either. In the 3/4 empty stadium, everyone gravitated to the courtside seats we can't normally afford. This is a disorientating time to be in Israel. More than 90% of Israeli adults are now either vaccinated or have recovered from the coronavirus. It is a world-beating achievement. Restaurants and bars, as well as sports and music venues, reopened a month ago after nearly a year of lockdowns and strict social distancing. Some restrictions remain in place, such as the necessary requirement for face masks to be worn in open spaces. All activities are officially subject to those attending having a green pass. But the reality is that you barely ever, if at all, get asked to show your pass. One restaurant in Jerusalem, I noticed that they started asking for green passes, but have now given up. Millions of Israelis downloaded their green passes after the government rolled them out. There was a massive PR campaign encouraging us to use them, but there was little guidance on how to enforce them. Officially, it's the responsibility of businesses and venues to ensure that only those with the passes are allowed in. No one told me how I was supposed to police the green passes, one Tel Aviv bar owner told me. I'm leaving it to my customers. I hope no one who hasn't been vaccinated comes in, but it's not my responsibility. Police and local authority inspectors have been discreetly ordered not to enforce the regulations either. The truth is that the green pass was never really meant to be a condition for getting into places, one senior public health expert admitted to me. It was meant as an incentive so younger people would feel they were going to get something out of being vaccinated. Israel's quick vaccine rollout has indeed been the envy of the world, but at one point, when about a third of the population had been jabbed, the daily rate of vaccinations began to plummet. It turned out that while those over 60 were eager to be vaccinated and reunite with their families, younger Israelis were in less of a hurry. It was the government's promise of a green pass, which would allow their favorite haunts to finally reopen, that got them off their backsides and into the vaccination centers. It did the trick. Nearly all Israeli adults now have a vaccine passport, which means there's no need to inspect them. Some workplaces have made them a condition of returning to the office, even though the legality of such a requirement is far from clear. But all you're asked to provide is a screenshot or photocopy of your pass for personnel file. No one checks whether it's authentic. Unlike in Britain, where the idea of vaccine passports is still anathema, Israelis are used to being required to carry identity cards with them wherever they go. If the government here was serious about vaccine passports, they would enforce them. But the Green Pass did its job as a way of encouraging everyone to get their vaccine. Nearly everyone took up the offer. Infection rates have been steadily going down, and Israel's economy has been able to reopen. It's now almost impossible to get a table in the better restaurants without a week's advance reservation. A Green Pass won't help you there.
That was Anshul Pfeffer, and finally, Lionel Shriver.
In my teens, rubbishing the implacable edifice of the United States felt like kicking a tank in trainers. Richard Nixon's silent majority was patriotic. Railing about my country's disgraceful historical underbelly, slavery, the Native American genocide, seemed edgy. Fast forward, and in the West, trashing your own country has become a central preoccupation of the ruling class. University administrators, corporate board members, and media pundits compete with one another over who can denounce their disgusting society with more fervor. Shame, or what passes for it, is the new ostentation. America's own president decries his country's systemic racism far more than singing along with the Star-Spangled Banner at a football game, or, God forbid, Rule Britannia at the proms. Joining the chorus proclaiming the odiousness of America or Britain has become downright conformist. One reason why pooping all over the land of my birth ceased long ago to be any fun. Now that self-loathing has gone mainstream, the government commissioned report last week attesting that the UK is not institutionally racist is what qualifies as genuinely edgy. Its assertion that, rather, Britain should act as a model for other white-majority countries is what qualifies as genuinely brave. For sure enough, its lead author, the head of the Commission on Race and Ethnic Disparities, drew comparison to Goebbels. On Twitter, a Labour MP equated the commissioners with cross-burners in the Ku Klux Klan. On The Guardian's front page, the mother of murdered teenager Stephen Lawrence decried the report's heretical conclusions as giving racists the green light. On Channel 4 News, a former Met police superintendent slammed the document as having set back racial equality for decades. Now, That's one powerful pile of paper. So over the top, so foam at the mouth, so eye-bulgingly hypertensive was the immediate response to the gaslighting report that the exhibition was almost comical. The lessons are clear. Nowadays, moral nuance is anathema. And defend your country at your peril. Given the vitriol they've faced, we shouldn't be surprised if the report's authors, 9 out of 10 non-white, are forced into hiding. Only one conclusion would have raised no hackles: that the UK is irredeemably, irretrievably, unpardonably racist, down to the cellular level, and damned for all time. For that's not some fringe opinion. It's the view embraced by what we once called the establishment, what conservatives now tag the liberal elite, and what for its membership simply qualifies as the ranks of the civilized. Clearly, progressive posturing in both Britain and America is meant for domestic consumption. Paintballing the flag is an in-house sport. But what prevents theatrical ecstasies of national self-mortification from being merely amusing? A passing political fashion that, alas, doesn't seem to be passing fast enough. Is who else is watching the show? The Chinese Communist Party may restrict its people's internet access, but the leadership keeps tabs on The Guardian, The New York Times, and Channel 4 News. Accordingly, during the bilateral summit in Alaska last month, the U.S. Secretary of State briefly expressed his deep concern over human rights in China, only to be met with an 18-minute attack from his Chinese counterpart, charging that America didn't have a leg to stand on. Quote, "There are many problems within the United States regarding human rights, which is admitted by the U.S. itself as well. The challenges facing the United States in human rights are deep-seated. They did not just emerge over the past 4 years, such as Black Lives Matter." With the help of progressive propaganda, then, the CCP establishes a moral equivalence between the imprisonment of 1 million Uyghurs in forced labor concentration camps, where women are subjected to compulsory sterilization, and the killing of one black citizen by a policeman currently on trial for it and in line for a sentence of up to 40 years. A country that allows dissent, including the derogation of the state itself, looks strong. And in this respect, the control freaks of the CCP, frightened of their own people, look weak. But a country that adopts self-excoriation as its national pastime also looks weak. The Chinese are keeping attentive watch as the West denigrates its heroes, debunks its previous sources of pride, vandalizes its icons, denounces its cultural heritage, slanders its popular majorities as indelibly stained with original sin, and rewrites its history to make its past appear as wicked as possible. The spectacle inspires contempt. The Chinese see the self-flagellating throes of the West as the certain bellwether of terminal decline. We're making ourselves look pathetic. In countries and individuals both, a penchant for self-criticism is only healthy when balanced by some measure of self-belief. I've no taste for the texture of Chinese nationalism. The militaristic displays, the synchronized marching, the numbing pomp, the hundreds of vacuously pretty young women dressed in red, singing bouncy songs in mincing voices. The Chinese are drilled from birth on their great country, their great people, their great leaders, and their great destiny. All that patriotic indoctrination may be nauseating, but it gives the CCP an enormous popular solidarity to draw upon. The rancid rhetoric of today's left may be playing to the peanut gallery. Aside from fetishizing Palestinians, identitarians are provincial. Progressives display little interest in Myanmar, Xinjiang, or Alexei Navalny's fate in Russia. But trendy denunciation of our awful people, awful history, and awful cultures doesn't stay all in the family. It's music to the ears of our adversaries, whose illiberal ambitions are primarily constrained by fear. Why fear a society that's tearing itself apart for you? Alert to what looks from afar like decadence, decay, and implosion, China is further emboldened to quash Hong Kong, annex the entire South China Sea, and bully Australia for daring to desire more research into the origins of COVID-19. Mind, geopolitics aren't always abstract. Towards the end of the Vietnam War, my older brother was wrestling with whether to flee to Canada before being rescued by a lucky draft number. I'd hate to see our unsuspecting wokesters face a similar dilemma when China invades Taiwan.
That was Lionel Shriver. Thanks for listening to this episode of Spectator Out Loud. And remember, if you like this podcast, do rate and review us wherever you get your podcasts from, and why not tell a friend about it too. Thanks for listening, and join us again next week.